and Apex Lab Podcast. Hey there, welcome to the Level Up Engineering Podcast, where we speak to the most experienced technology leaders from around the world. So stay with us to learn actionable management insights to take your engineering team to the next level. This show is powered by Apex Lab, a team of experts in end-to-end digital product development. ApexLab.io.
Welcome to the Level Up Engineering Podcast. I am Carolina Toth, and today I am here with another accomplished technology leader. Please welcome to the studio, Ian Tien. Hi, Ian. It is awesome to have you here.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Today, we are going to talk about something that is very dear to my heart. But before that, it would be great if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Yeah, thank you so much. So I started my career in Microsoft engineering in Microsoft Office. I have about a dozen patents from different technologies and analytics and collaboration from there. And from there, I moved to graduate school. I did a business and public policy degree. And while I was in school, I started a video game company sort of from my dorm room. And we were doing HTML5 video games, which was back in, I think, 2012, where HTML5 was potentially going to replace Flash. We were trying to be cutting edge. And we kind of found out that no one wanted to buy an HTML5 platform because it was all client side and, you know, there was really no IP protection. So we really couldn't license or do anything with it. We ended up turning into a video game studio. So we started making real-time strategy games on HTML5 back in 2012. I won a few awards. We grew the business. We got into Y Combinator, raised some venture funding from some amazing investors. And, you know, sometime around sort of 2015, we built this open source project, which is now called Mattermost. And originally we built it for ourselves. We were a small business. We were all working remote, using chat operations for everything. And we kind of said, okay, well, this is a platform that we need and we might as well open source it because, you know, that's kind of fun to do and we can have more people interested. And what happened was this enterprise company, you know, one of the tech giants out there said, hey, we're really interested in Mattermost. You build really good software. We're ex-Microsoft. And they said, hey, we'd love to get a commercial version of this. And we're like, well, we're a video game company and, you know, we don't really do that. And it's like, well, we just need, you know, we need like some single sign-on, some like compliance features and some security things. And we're like, okay, we'll do it. And then another tech giant, like a few months later, said, well, we want the same thing. We want to customize. We want to build these things. We're like, okay, we're not really an enterprise software company. This is kind of for us, but we'll do it because, you know, this is like just really cool to contribute to some of these amazing enterprises. And then we got our first sort of government inquiry. And that was a really big build for us. And it was really clear. This all happened in sort of a matter of months around 2016 that this was a business that was, you know, built on the open source technology, but with a commercial version on top, which a lot of people call open core. And, you know, that kind of became Mattermost. We shut down the video games and we're doing Mattermost full time. And it's been fantastic. So Mattermost today, you know, started off as open source and really has been, we discovered, a collaboration solution for mission critical work. So a lot of organizations that are in defense or government or utilities, banking, financial services, any organization where public safety or national security could be compromised, if these systems stop working, they really need a collaboration solution that's going to be resilient, that's going to be adaptable to their custom needs, and really lets them focus on the most important work at these vital organizations. And it was a complete surprise from starting a video game company, moving over to critical infrastructure. So that's a little bit of the story of how we started and sort of my journey along the way.
And based on this introduction, it seems like you're the kind of guy who has his job as a hobby. But if you could share something, you know, like something that is personal to you or your hobbies, so we could get to know you a little better.
Yeah, I think my biggest hobby is just socializing with friends. I'm an extrovert. If you'd actually test me on the Myers-Briggs, I'm sort of like 30 out of 30 on the extrovert side. So as an example, I'll keep in touch with, you know, hundreds and hundreds of friends. You know, I'll do happy hours. If I'm in a city for business, I'll try to get a bunch of people together. And I think, you know, one of my hobbies is really spending time. I learn so much from spending time with other people. So organizing happy hours or hikes or poker games or whatever it is, I'm always sort of socializing, and that group of friends just becomes, you know, lifelong. I think one of the things about being an engineer with a dozen patents, going to business school, is that, you know, people say, well, you go there for the relationships, and it sounds kind of shallow, but it's actually quite deep, because these are the relationships that echo on your life and change your life from the different perspectives, from, you know, people helping each other, from, you know, really powerful friendships that echo on. So I just think if there's a hobby I have, it's really spending time with friends and making new friends.
I completely agree with you on that one. And that's partially why I love to do these podcasts, because I learn a lot from the people I meet. We are sort of starting out a new thing where before we start with the topic, we want to ask all of our guests some deep question to, you know, dive deep from the beginning. So if you would like to share a hot take or something that you believe to be true, but a lot of people maybe don't agree with you, if you can share something like that, I think that would be really cool.
Yeah, very happy to. I try to do these whenever I can. I notice something and I'll sort of post on LinkedIn about it. I think the one, if I was doing a hot take for my LinkedIn profile today, I think every enterprise needs out-of-band communication. And this is, you know, everyone's using sort of like, you know, Microsoft Teams, or they're using, you know, WhatsApp, or they're using some other sort of system, communicate, Slack or Google or all these different things. And that's their primary. And the hot take is, whatever you're doing as sort of one, there's been a theme to consolidate, is wrong. And why that's wrong is because you need at least one more. So if your security organization is defending your primary infrastructure, they're defending Microsoft Teams or defending Cisco WebEx, if they're defending it, then they need a system that is separate from that core main system. So for example, if I'm a security organization, I'm defending a network, I can't be on that network. If I'm a security organization defending Microsoft Teams or Microsoft 365, I can't be part of that system. And the reason why is because if an attacker exploits that primary system that you used to defend, and you start reacting to that exploit on that system, then all your vulnerability information is spilling into the attacker's database, right? And you can take a small breach and it turns into a major failure if you're in this model where the security team isn't independent of the system that they're attacking. That they're defending. So, you know, for the engineers and IT folks in particular out there, just be super careful. It's like, if you experience a breach, if you're getting these, you know, CVEs, if you're reacting to vulnerabilities that are in the news, don't use whatever system is breached to start reacting to it, because your information could be spilling out and you can make something much, much worse. So out-of-band communications is something that a lot of people don't think about. They think about, oh, efficiency, consolidation, reach everybody. But I would say, you know, out-of-band communications is one of the most important things, fundamental for any security organization. So that's my hot take today.
Thank you. I will now then go over to today's topic, which is basically engineering principles for iterative and customer-centric design. Let's dive into it right now and say, how does a customer-centric approach contribute to the success of any engineering project? Or how does it contribute to your success?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think in open source, one of the things that, if you're building an open source business out there, it's so important to understand, who are you building for? And in terms of a customer-centric approach, when you're building an open source piece, very often you're building it for people who use open source, right? Who are very used to open source tools, and you want to build for them. When it's time to build an open core business and say, well, there's a license on top and you can buy these other things, that typically is built for something, for people that don't use open source. which is kind of like paradoxical. And when you build a commercial version of something, you're actually building it very often for IT if you're an open source business. So for developers, here's an open source tool. You can use it. It's great. You love it. And then you have IT-oriented things that are going to be commercial. For example, compliance. You know, it's like management operation, administrative features. If you want to lock down a whole bunch of things, in many cases, the developers actually don't want that, right? The IT people do, right? But the developers actually have less freedom when you lock it down. And the IT people need that for compliance and be like, okay, let me organize this. Let me put it this way so I can make things, you know, more manageable. So I think a customer-centric approach to building engineering projects is really knowing your audience, knowing that we're building for, let's say, developers and users, which are just like us in open source cases. And when we go to commercial versions, we're building for someone different, who someone has a different set of needs. So I think that's something that we've learned for ourselves, and I think it's really applicable to all engineers in their career, in that, you know, who's the audience we're building for, and, you know, what is that profile, and what is going to make them, you know, super happy and enabled on the other side.
So do you mean like for example, I can think of a software. I don't know if this is really a good example, but like Jira, where you have some freedom, but not really a lot of freedom when you interact with the software, or something like Miro, which is completely different, but also is available for using for project organization. Are you saying that it's better for also the engineers to like make sure they understand the customer's problem, sort of in their own skin?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Jira is a great example because you've got developers who are like, okay, I need to be able to, okay, what's the issue? How do I flag it? How do I put information in? Let me add attachments, all those things that are developers. And then there's a separate, what you think of as what's called SKUs, stock keeping units, or packages. You can think of packages. So there's a package that's made for the developers, and everyone gets productive, and that could even be free sometimes. And it's like, okay, great, developers have all their needs. What about the engineering manager? What are things that they care about? And what do we put in this other package? So one example would be like burn down charts, mm-hmm. right? Burn down charts are like, okay, I'm going to track this information and I'm going to see what the sprint is like. And we'll see how I'm burning down and see how good I'm at estimating and which managers are better at estimating than others. So that's a package for someone who's doing engineering management. And it's not necessarily something a developer would want. In fact, it might be the opposite sometimes, because now developers have to track their time and, you know, they have to do this extra work. So the engineering manager gets the reports that they need. But that's an example of building something for the right audience. You're building for developers to be fast. You're building for engineering managers to have the data that they need and to make the decisions and have the visualization. So those are examples of products that people use every day. And just thinking about, as an engineer, what's really important to that end audience, which is going to be different. It's going to be, why is this so controversial? Why do some users like it and some users don't? Because some users are engineers that don't like entering their time tracking. And some people are engineering managers that really love the data on the other side. So, you know, how do you analyze the different feedback from all these end users is you don't treat them the same. You underize, oh, they have a role, they have a responsibility. How do we fit what we build in the context of what they need?
I also think that in the general field out there, there are business analysts who are basically paid to understand kind of the customer, and then they are the ones who go over to engineering and say, look, this is what our customer is like, or this is what our customer needs. Would you elaborate what you mean by, you know, the engineers understanding the customers? Like, do you think it's enough to have business analysts speak to engineers?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, one of the things we talk about is principles and why they're important. So at Mattermost, one of our principles is customer obsession. And our principle of customer obsession is saying, hey, kind of start and end with the customer all the time. And it's not just the business analysts who are between the developers and the end customer. Because when that happens, a lot of the business analysts aren't technical, and they're not able to communicate the problem. And the problem, and what happens is, let me give you an example and a story about this. You know, business analysts will go in and be like, oh, this customer wants another table. It's like, and then the engineer is like, okay, well, that table's really expensive. It's going to change the architecture. It's going to change upgrades. Like, what do you mean a table? It's like, well, here's all the things that they need. And, you know, they need a table. And they need a table because they want to be able to do like this, this query. So the engineer, and we have this sort of principle at Mattermost, which is over a certain sort of amount of work, like not every single feature, but if something's like kind of expensive, then we track for those really expensive items, how many have the engineers actually spoken with the end customer, the person who's requesting it? Like, you know, business analysts can introduce them. Not everything, right? Business analysts can go out there and get some preliminary information. But anything that's really expensive, have that engineer talk to the end customer. And what we find over and over again is when you take an engineer and you take them to the end customer, something really, really expensive, the engineer finds ways, almost always, to make it way less expensive. Because they have the technical context, and when they get the business context, they can solve it. It's not for everything. It's just for the really expensive things. So the example of, oh, we need a table, when the engineer actually spoke to the end user, the person that was requesting it, it's like they didn't actually need a table. They just needed a column. Mm. Right. But because the business analyst didn't understand the architecture of the system, right, then they're like, we need a table when really you just need a column. So those are examples of customer obsession as a principle. And, you know, not for everything, but the big things, moving over, making better decisions.
Could you share some more of those principles with us? I love customer obsession, but I'm sure there are more.
Yeah. Another principle we have at Mattermost is called self-awareness. So self-awareness is, you know, really understanding ourselves, our capabilities, how our customers perceive us. There's fear sometimes that, like, if you ask the question, you know, how would you rate, you know, the ability to receive notifications, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10 for our app, which is really messaging, you know, there's a fear that people are going to say it's not very good, right? But you have to, when you force the question, it's like, oh, it's like they qualitative, like, oh, this piece is amazing. It's really great. You know, it's like, what would you rate? 3 out of 10. Wow. Why is it 3 out of 10? You said all these qualitative things. It's like, well, when I'm mobile using my VPN and I'm changing between cellular and Wi-Fi networks, like the app freezes and I have to restart it. So wow, like self-awareness, asking the question, asking quantified questions, close-ended questions to get a sense of, you know, what's working, what's not. Self-awareness is another principle. Other principles about, you know, earning trust is super important. We earn trust through our open source code, through documentation, through different guides. Like, how do we earn trust of our customers, of our end users? High impact is another one of our principles, which is if you can choose between low impact things and high impact things, pick the highest impact, right? Sometimes people spend a lot of time working to make something beautiful that's really not, you know, that important. I was in an engineering review the other day, we're looking at, oh, we're doing this end-to-end, you know, load testing. And it's like, okay, it's part of our process. Like, what's the negative consequence if we didn't do load testing? And we kind of thought about it. And it's like, oh, actually, it's a very small table and there's really no like catastrophic failure scenario, right? So, you know, sometimes you go through checklists and you're kind of just following the looking out the rearview mirror to drive the car and just kind of like going on this path. But when you think about analytically, is this high impact versus the other engineering projects that we have in the backlog, we can sort of mix and match. So high impact, being having customer obsession, having self-awareness, earning trust, those are some of our principles that matter most. And you can read our handbook online, but those are some of the principles we use to build great product.
You have already mentioned that that this affects the development process when you think about, you know, like how high impact is this ticket I am working on, or is this epic I'm working on, or so. But do you have sort of like processes in place to live the engineering principles?
Yeah, there's, of course, release management processes. There's a lot of team process. There's lots of cadence that's sort of built in. So we release every month and we have, you know, just a regular cadence to move things out. What we found is super helpful is this concept of operating reviews, right? Operating reviews are, hey, let's think about metrics around sort of quality. Let's think about, you know, let's think about delivery velocity, you know, all these different metrics. And, you know, we don't think of them also like Grafana dashboards, right? Like you've got this kind of heartbeat that's kind of going out. But they're kind of in the background. And they're these metrics that we use are really only sort of part of the story. They're just kind of like a Grafana dashboard. And we have to really say, well, what's the context, you know, behind these numbers so that, you know, they're not all the story, but they really support the story. So I'll give you an example. We're an open source company and we're saying, oh, why did sort of pull requests per engineer go down this month? Oh, it's because there was an offsite. And they all were traveling. So, you know, they're just a little less productive. Okay, that's fine. It's part of the story. Another month, whoa, how come like pull requests per developer were so high? It's because, well, that was October, which in the open source community is known as, you know, Hacktoberfest. And we had a lot of open source contributions come in. It's the number one, you know, time of year to make open source contributions. So we had these really great numbers. And that's the context. So as we have these monthly reviews, one of the powerful tools we use is called a GNN. GNN. G is going well, N is not going well, and the other N is what are your next actions? So we've got, you know, metrics, we've got the high-level narrative, and we say on a monthly basis, what's going well? What are things that are, we should celebrate? And we're like, this is amazing. We discovered this thing, and maybe it's from a team, and we want to spread it across the whole organization. And if it's going well, elevate, celebrate, and see, hey, where can we use this? Where can we take something that we learned or outperformed on and apply it other places? Not going well is fine, right? Not going well is the mirror image, part of our value of self-awareness. You know, what are the not going wells that we saw in this last month? And when we say not going well, we also want to say, well, what's the next action? The next thing we want to do to kind of move that in the right direction. So, you know, if a project's behind, maybe we have to move resources to help accelerate that project, or we have to reduce the scope of that project. But on a monthly basis, we get to have these really powerful conversations and make decisions that make everything flow faster and smoother. So, I think of all different tools, of course, cadence, release process, monthly release, sprint planning, all those pieces. But one that has worked really well for us is a concept of that monthly operating view and the GNN, going well, not going well, and next actions.
It sounds like it's a retrospective that you do. Is it very different from a regular retrospective? Do you have the entire team come, or is it specific to every team? How do you do them?
Yeah, that's excellent. So yes, it's kind of like retrospective. At the same time, it's standardized across the entire company. Mm-hmm. So sales will have one, you know, customer success will have one, you know, finance will have one, and engineering will have one. And it's a little bit, the goal is to be kind of tight and really talking about, you know, one of our principles, high impact. What's the high impact GNN? What's going well, not going well, and the key next action. And being able to share that information out across the company is really important. And what we do is we'll do sort of a monthly review of, you know, we take all those GNNs and we use narrative, right? So they might like, what is the, you know, one or two paragraphs, right? Going well, not going well, next actions. And really, what do you want to convey to the company? And when you ask folks to convey to the whole company, you really get to that high impact. You really get to that essence. And the reflection of that is, well, the other departments do the same thing. So everyone can see, oh, how's everything working together, right? So for example, if we're seeing in sales, wow, we're winning these new accounts and they're this type of customer. Well, that gives everyone visibility that this is what's going to come in terms of onboarding and potentially new feature requests and things like that. And likewise, you know, if we see, you know, a feature is ahead of schedule or a little behind schedule, that gives everyone awareness. So you can think about as retrospectives are sort of the inputs to the GNN, but the GNN is going to be like, what's the most highest impact? What is the strategic relevance of, you know, all the operational and tactical pieces that are sort of day to day? So it really is sort of a concentration of those retrospectives and those next actions that are declared to the whole company.
It almost sounds like it's not only customer obsession, but maybe understanding obsession, because what you said made it seem like that probably engineering in your company is more aware of the rest of the company than engineering at other companies, I would imagine. It sounds like you share a lot.
It's really this principle of self-awareness. So coming back and saying, hey, self-awareness is one of our core values. How are we self-aware of ourselves? You know, one of the things that happens is people come from different cultures. And some of the cultures in big companies, they don't have self-awareness as a value. And it's kind of the opposite. People kind of work in silos and they're saying like, hey, we don't want to share. I mean, this is not necessarily a bad thing. Some organizations just need to be secretive, right? You can think of like, you know, Apple historically has been an example where like you've got this super secret project, the hardware is in a black bag that no one can see. There's certain rooms you can't get into. And that's, you know, that's a different culture, right? That's a very sort of, you know, deliberately sort of compartmentalized culture versus a culture where self-awareness in open source is really important. And we're saying, hey, you know, we're an open source company. Like, it's not like you have to talk to product management to find out if the feature is coming. You can actually look in the code base. We've actually had customers who like just came out, you know, sales will talk to them. They're like, oh, we're thinking about Mattermost. Like, we get a quote and there's like super quiet. And salespeople thought, oh, we thought we lost the deal. And then they'll come back to sales like, we're ready to buy. And it's like, oh, why are you ready to buy now? It's because the feature that we wanted, we saw checked into the code base. And now that's what we've been waiting for. So like, we're ready to buy. So like that kind of level of transparency for open source and that sort of norm of self-awareness of saying, here's what's going well, here's what's not going well, here's the next action you want to take. All those are a system that works together. It's not a system that will work necessarily at every company, but that's a system that works here, and it works really well.
How do you find the engineers who are more open to this level of transparency? Or is it something that is like an acquired taste where no matter the beginning stance of the engineer, once they join the company, they will find that it's a working model?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we have our open source, you know, we have our principles in our handbook. We have a handbook for how development works. You can go on GitHub and just watch everything sort of working, and you can see the caliber of the engineers that work here. So it's a little bit of a self-selection process. You can't really hide in open source, right? Like, you know, people will be, as we recruit people, like a lot of people come from open source. You don't have to, but when you come from open source, it's easier because you can see, okay, they get the open source culture. They get that you know, it's all transparent, that they're, you know, making pull requests and responding to them and doing the proper reviews. It's really easy for someone coming from an open source environment to go to another open source environment. The other cultural piece we have is where a lot of us are ex-Microsoft. So mm-hmm. folks that understand the Microsoft culture and, you know, that, you know, there's a lot of pieces that translate over in terms of, you know, how we think and some of the principles there. And the last one is really just, you know, in that hiring team, like everyone is sort of trained to look for the culture and the values. So all those pieces come together and help us grow that the level of quality over and over again.
Maybe I'm wrong about this, but open source kind of makes it seem like you have built a brand that speaks for itself, you know, like an employer branding strategy without having to do anything about it. I mean, you put it out there, so it's visible to anyone who is interested.
Yeah, that's a great point. Absolutely. I think when people go in there and they're like, well, do I want to work for that closed source company over there? Or do I want to work for that open source company over here? You know, for engineers, it is just, you know, way, way better to work for open source companies, right? You can just, it's, you know, when I was at Microsoft, me and my co-founder, Corey Hewlin, we were at Microsoft. When we left, you know, we didn't have a scrap of what we built. I've got, you know, 12 patents, he's got 30 patents, but we didn't get to keep any of that source code. We'll never see it again. It's locked away in some archive and it's gone forever. Whereas here, you know, people here, like whatever a lot of the things we build in open source, you know, your kids will grow up one day and they'll learn to code and they'll be able to read it. And you're like, that's what my mom or my dad was building. And there's that history and that sort of legacy. And, you know, even if folks decide to, hey, move on to a different role, they get to kind of keep all those things. And I think the secret of open source that people don't realize is that the more you give away, the more you actually keep, because that, as you said before, is part of your brand. And that's going to echo on. And when they go back and they read about this engineer and the most amazing source code that wrote for Mattermost, you know, that just echoes on over and over again, which is completely different for a proprietary company.
Right. Do you think these principles could be implemented in other industries as well? Because I imagine you consider yourself a tech company to begin with.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I think in terms of other industries sort of outside of tech, I think what I hope is government can be one of those industries. So what you'll find a lot in government, we support a lot of government organizations. One of the things that Mattermost does, because it's open source, it's also self-sovereign, which means that if I'm an organization, I want, and I'm government on critical infrastructure, I can host everything myself. I can be independent of the world and just run things without, you know, other things in the world might go wrong, might be some sort of dispute, but, you know, we can run sort of independently. That's what a lot of governments say they want to do. I think the biggest opportunity for this category called GovTech, right, is to be more transparent. Because if GovTech is transparent, then all these governments can learn from each other. And they can standardize on a lot of things they do. Every government needs to issue a driver's license, right? Every government needs people to pay taxes. And what happens when there's not transparency is a lot of these things are services-based software solutions, and they're all different and they're all incompatible. And maybe that service provider goes out of business and they don't know how to maintain it. And these government services, you know, grind to a halt. So I think if there's anything that can make the world materially better, right, whether it's like getting your driver's license totally digital, whether it's, you know, getting a license for your home or collecting property tax, you know, all this can be really revolutionized if we standardize. Things probably cost 10 times more in government than they need to, because you're building it all custom instead of having transparency on, well, what's everyone using, and being able to drive the cost, you know, materially lower, and to get the best capabilities for the lowest cost through transparency across governments. That's good for everyone. That's good for all taxpayers. It's good for all governments. That's good for sort of civilization as a whole. And it's a big bottleneck right now because there's not transparency.
Because there is secrecy within governments. I just had a conversation with Robert Hodges from Altinity. That was also a conversation about open source. And we also ended up around, you know, like how to make the world a better place. And it kind of seems to me that open source is somehow going in that direction in every conversation, which I love. And you mentioned the government technologies, and I think you are completely right. If you don't mind me asking, do you think that is possible to have more transparency across governments?
Yeah, absolutely. I've met people who are on the leading edge of that GovTech initiatives and bring people together, and they'll have, you know, forums, and then transparency begins with conversation. You know, we talked earlier about like sort of my hobbies and sort of bringing people together and making friends. And there's people like that out there that are doing that on a professional basis, and they're creating, you know, one nation talking to another nation, talking to digital services. I think Scotland's actually got this really great program where they're doing all sorts of innovations. And what they do is they open up these challenges transparently to industry, because very often you're like, I think there was, I'm going to get the facts wrong. So these aren't the real facts, but like, as an example, they need to find a way to sense, I think, like it was rain or water levels or something. And it would cost, you know, $100,000 to create this unit from the industrial base. And they opened up this challenge, and they figured out a way to do it for a few $100, you know, reusing a few sensors, right? So just people see the problems that government needs to solve, and having transparency and the opportunity to innovate and create these solutions, and also do that in an open forum where other people can say, wow, you know, we have that same need and we can go do it. So instead of having it sort of like consulting or sales-driven solutions for government, you know, what if the problems were open-sourced, the solutions were open-sourced, and there was infrastructure to really share the problems and solutions and really get to better outcomes. That there's people that are innovating in government. After this call, I can introduce you if you like, and we can figure out, and that would be a great topic, and how to apply these open-source principles and the sharing to other industries.
I would love that. And I also think, why would you need to reinvent the wheel if someone else already has the wheel? However, without getting too much into politics, because I don't know anything about politics, but I have met enough people to know that there are a lot of other underlying motives, and not all people are into making the entire world a better place, just making their own world maybe a little better. Could you share some stories where you think these core engineering principles contributed to the success of Mattermost?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, self-awareness, I kind of go back to that over and over again. I'll share a couple of stories. One was, and I think the key one is that, like, you know, when I was at Microsoft, they created this product called Windows Vista. And Windows Vista came after Windows XP. And I know I'm really old, so my old person stories, but like, we were shipping Windows Vista, which was the successor to Windows XP, and it was very difficult to use. And, you know, when we took our laptops and we upgraded to the beta version of Windows XP, we sometimes couldn't get through a meeting without the battery dying on the Windows on the machine. And we're like, well, why is that? It's because, you know, in order to do Windows XP, Microsoft bought all the engineers the most high-powered desktops with lots of RAM and big graphics cards. And Windows XP was built and compiled and designed on these really beefy machines. So when they got to laptop versus Windows XP, like when Windows XP was created, all the machines were really slow. Like developers didn't have slow machines. So Windows XP was very efficient. When Windows Vista shipped, because it was built on beefy machines, you know, we had these performance problems and battery problems. And it wasn't until Windows 7 that we really corrected all these. And it was really this sort of blind spot, right? Not being self-aware. An example at Mattermost, you know, we kind of had the same problem, right? We have like, oh, but it's not, you know, it doesn't like the performance on this application doesn't like Windows doesn't work as well. Like, why is that? And then we found out that all the developers were on Macs with 32 gigs of RAM, right? And they'd never use Windows. So, you know, it would lag behind. You know, that's being fixed with, you know, getting people secondary computers that are going to be non-developer machines so they can reproduce things. So one of the most important things is that self-awareness. You have to enable people to be self-aware. You don't want, like, if you go back and the business analyst is like, hey, like, we're having performance issues. They're like, we're trying so hard. Like, we don't have performance issues. We don't see it because you're on a Mac with 32 gigs, right? And you know, now that we were like, we solved the root problem. We said, it's not about, hey, like tops down, you know, this is a problem. We're going to have you solve it. It's like, give people the opportunity to experience what our end users are experiencing when they're on, you know, lower cost machines that are running Windows and not Mac. And then they can see the problems up front and they don't really have to manage anything. They're just so self-aware. They'll fix it themselves. They can debug it themselves and everything becomes easy. So, you know, that's an example of that principle of self-awareness. Whether it's for big companies like Microsoft or sort of like growth stage companies like Mattermost, if you give people the context to be self-aware, then amazing things happen. You don't really need that much management. People can go figure those pieces out for themselves.
Do you believe in having less managers all across the industry?
I think, well, managers is maybe a separate topic. It's not so much the number of managers. Mm-hmm. It's sort of who they are. I think, you know, in engineering managers and product, for us, we like to have technical managers who really can understand. And sometimes sometimes they're going to be more player coach, which means that they'll still code and they'll manage some people versus, you know, pure functional managers who might manage, you know, 8 to 12 to 15 sort of engineers. And they're sort of like a day-to-day manager. Then they sort of float away from the technology. They were technical, but unless you're sort of keeping that up, you sort of float away. I think, you know, either of those sort of can work. Like, you're going to get to a certain spot where you need that senior level that is maybe not coding hands-on, but there's really that executive leadership. And you have to find the right balance between sort of hands-on work and sort of pure management. There's a failure case here, which is, you know, and we're, you know, like other companies, you know, we're trying to work this out, which is, what is the career path for individual contributors without management? Because mm-hmm. sometimes there's this default, which is not good, which is like, oh, this person's an amazing performer, amazing engineer. Let's give them someone to manage, right? And it's like, well, sometimes that makes sense, right? You want to train and coach other people and bring them up. And sometimes it doesn't make sense because like that star brings in four more people, right? They've never managed before in their career. Now they're managing a team of four. That team of four plus that manager is only maybe 20% more efficient than that person by themselves. Right. So you've built this big org that's not putting, you got so much communication overhead, that it's actually, you know, not really that efficient. But we kind of force this upon a lot of managers just because of how we built our systems. So what's important for us is to have that architect track, that sort of, you know, and we think about a few flavors. We're still working this out on our career ladders and pieces, but the concept of, hey, you've got sort of like architect, you know, they're, you know, large organizations. Their job is to sort of decrease the technical debt of the organization, right? And it's the best ones are going to be a little unstructured. They're going to figure it out as they go along. They're going to talk to people. They're going to offer being in reviews. And they'll just figure out how to very high IQ as well as EQ to navigate and to turn that into a high functioning architecture and organization. So that's one is kind of an architect. Another example of career path is this concept of sort of field CTO, right? They're not, and some people have them in the marketing function. Some people have an engineering function, but they'll go out there, they'll tell the story, they'll give demos, and they'll just really be this brand ambassador for the organization. Developer relations, you can kind of go up developer relations from that. You can kind of be engineering and or technical marketing and go in that track. But that's another sort of individual track that can have, you know, managerial level impact. And the last one is this kind of army of one, right? They're not necessarily like an architect, like making everyone else better. They're not necessarily a marketer going out there and driving brand awareness. But they are, you know, an army of one, and they can build these like really powerful systems and move faster than a group. So examples, you'll see, of course, AI engineers out there that have deep knowledge. You'll see database optimization engineers, kind of army of one, people do things that a whole team couldn't do on their own. You know, when you think about the original iPhone, right? There was four apps in the original iPhone. Each of them was one engineer, right? Like the browser was one engineer in the iPhone 1.0. And it's that sort of army of one, job description. So there's ways that you can sort of, I would think about well, how many managers do you have to individual contributors? Like we do measure that as well. But it's really about, you know, what is the function of, you know, a manager versus kind of a player coach versus, you know, one of these really strong individual contributors. And at the leadership and executive levels, you kind of need a mix.
I love what you just explained. And I think there is a lot of potential in creating organizations where management is not something that is pushed on people or based on their technical skills, but also on their motivations and on their capability of growth. Could you talk a little more about how you came across these principles or how you developed these principles so that, because I would imagine that there are different principles for other companies, but there could be some similarities. So if someone is listening to us, could you share some of your process of creating these?
Yeah, very happy to. These kind of core values of the company and the mission of the company, it really happens in the early stages. So, you know, when we were a video game company and we transitioned to Mattermost and we transitioned to open source, you know, myself and Corey Hewlin, the co-founder, we would have these offsites. We'd bring people together. It was a very small company back then. And we just have a conversation. It's like, you know, what's important to us? What are our core values? And the core values do change over time. We do adjust some. We have added some. We've removed some. And it kind of comes over this process of, you know, what really matters and what's at the core. And as we kind of expand and the company grows, and then how do we adjust? We say, you know, what does it mean to be a star performer? What does it mean to be like, these people are amazing and we would want, you know, we would hire 10 of these, right? These are the people at the organization that are really, really top. And how do they behave? What makes them extraordinary? What makes them great contributors? And what are the principles that they really care about? And it's just sort of noticing, it's like, what's the pattern that works really well in our culture? So I think, you know, at one point, this is, you know, probably 4 or 5 years ago, we had some quality issues, right? Because people were sort of building code and they really want to build new stuff and weren't sort of maintaining things. And then we had this concept, the principle of earn trust, right? Which is more than, you know, it's not about just sort of quality or documentation or having transparency in the source code, but it's all the different things. How do we earn trust in this? Do people trust, you know, the product? Do they trust us as a company? So as opposed to saying, you know, quality is job one, we say, hey, how do we earn trust? And we say, here's examples of earning trust in terms of, you know, reliability, in terms of scale, in terms of feature completeness and all the different pieces. And we say, hey, our job is to earn trust. And that conversation, we tried sort of different variations, and then we kind of got to that earn trust principle. It's really, and it carries a lot of context. So I'd say in the early days, your founders, your early team really spend time and deliberately think about it. As you go and you iterate, how do you think about the stars and how do you think about the people and the excellence that's out there and identify it and name it and work to build that, incorporate that into the values, into the behaviors every day?
It kind of seems like you dissected trust and then put it back together. And I think that's a very interesting thought process because trust sometimes seems like such an elusive concept, you know, and how you just put it, it's just engineering. I love it. Looking forward, would you say that these principles will stay for good, or would you say that they will be iterated and evolved?
Yeah, I think companies are always going to be, you know, great companies are always going to be a work in progress. So there's no point in time where saying, nope, we can't learn anymore from where we are today. And I think they will continue to evolve and be defined and be refined. And it's really about, you know, what are the needs and what are we seeing as excellence and how do things change over time? I'll give you one concrete example. We used to have a principle called high standards. Mm-hmm. And then high standards was there, and then it was kind of conflicting with high impact as well as duplicate with earned trust. So we're like, oh, why did we have high standards? Like, why did we add that? Oh, it was actually in the early days we had those quality issues, so we had earned trust as well as high standards to kind of double do it. And over time, as quality kind of got better, it was really confusing because, like, what's the difference between high standards and earning trust, and whose standards are we going towards? And what happens is high standards started confusing all the other principles, right? High standards, well, we really, for example, customer obsession, right? Sometimes we have to get features out quicker and they're maybe alpha or beta versus GA. And high standards was conflicting with customer obsession because we were moving slower. High standards was conflicting with high impact because we're saying, you know, do the most important thing. It's, oh, but we have to polish this thing and just keep polishing high standards. So there's a lot of conflicts and there was confusion. So what worked in the early days, because we had to like fix a quality problem, right? Wasn't like the quality problem's kind of solved and we've got these other mechanisms. So we actually deleted high standards when it didn't feel like, you know, it was needed. It could be replaced in many other areas and incorporated to other values. So yeah, you know, history doesn't end today. We're going to continue to learn and continue to grow, and we're going to adapt and we're going to adapt our culture to really meet the needs of the day and the future.
With that said, we talked about a lot of things today, and I like to kind of give ourselves a summary, or what really stuck with me is that customer obsession and working together with other departments through these operating reviews and releasing every month are all things that at the end, and I don't want to be touchy-feely, but at the end, they, to me, all seem like creating empathy within the organization, for the organization and for the outside. And it's 2024, and I think empathy is one of the most important things that is a lot of times missing from the general conversation. So you talked about how these principles came to life, and you also talked about how they are always evolving and they are flexible enough so that as the company is evolving, they can be switched out or some other principles can be brought in. You also talked about how you wish that some of these principles from Mattermost and from generally the open source community could translate over to maybe governments, maybe other industries. And I think that would be really great to discover as to how us in IT could help that transition or maybe put ourselves out there even more so to help non-engineers understand these principles. Is there anything else that you would like to add to our conversation today?
Yeah, thank you. I think, you know, I would encourage everyone, IT and developers, to really think about sort of different open source technologies. And even the ones that are sort of like, they don't have to be, I think there's, look at open source technologies and there's two sides to this. One is look at open source in general for folks that only think about proprietary. Because there's this new generation of sort of commercial open source that is kind of the best of both worlds. So people who are used to proprietary, it's like, I like my Microsoft, I like my Cisco, that's great. There's great open source technologies like Elastic and HashiCorp and GitLab that have a really strong commercial offering, but they still have an open core where you can kind of understand, you know, all the different pieces and have transparency. So I'd encourage folks that are full proprietary to think about commercial open source as, yeah, you can trust this. There's a company behind it. These are public companies. You know, they're and you've got, you know, their public disclosures financially as well as their code is available. On the other side, I'd encourage folks that are sort of open source, maybe a little more purist on the purist end, to also consider commercial open source as the best of both worlds. Yes, you've got an open source version that you can understand and get your hands on. At the same time, you've got a commercial version for your work in the enterprise or in critical infrastructure that is really going to take a lot of the pressure points off of developers and give a sort of professional grade system for IT and all your different downstream stakeholders. So the last, you know, idea I'd leave folks with is, you know, if you're on the proprietary side, think about commercial open source to get a little more open. If you're a little bit more on the open source purist side, think about a commercial open source or product is going to be at least, you know, closer to open source than the pure proprietary. So there's a world in the middle. It's an amazing world. I encourage all the developers and IT folks to think about commercial open source as a new category of tools, as well as new careers, as well as new business models for them to consider.
I love this idea. Ian Tien, CEO and co-founder of Mattermost, where can our listeners follow you and your work?
Yeah, I'm at Ian Tien on X or Twitter. I'm Ian Tien at LinkedIn, and you can visit our website, Mattermost.com, to learn more. You can also find our Mattermost/Mattermost on GitHub if you want to check out the open source projects and all the open source work that we do.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I loved our conversation today, and I learned a lot again. Thank you for joining Level Up Engineering, dearest listeners and watchers. Today, my guest was Ian Tien, CEO and co-founder of Mattermost. Please check out the company and check out Ian if you liked our conversation today. I am Carolina Todd, and I hope to see you next time.
Thanks for staying with us. This was the Level Up Engineering Podcast by Apex Lab. Check them out at apexlab.io. And don't forget to subscribe to our channel, rate our content, and share your thoughts on this episode. See you next time.